Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University as part of the 200th anniversary of the ending of the U.S. Atlantic slave trade. Speaking will be University of Maryland Professor Ira Berlin. Dr. Berlin's lecture is titled "The Closing of the Slave Trade and the Transformation of Slavery in the U.S." We begin with an introduction by Ronald Richardson, Director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University. Professor Richardson.
Americans suffer from the peculiar disease of collective selective amnesia. And since we are what we remember, we have narrowed ourselves to be only that which reinforces what we think we are. Thus, America is still white. And even now, in 2008, we continue to decorate our currency with the pictures of slave owners and Indian killers. It will be said by hushed voices, he is committing the horrifying era of presentism, projecting into the past our own values and ideals. Washington, Jefferson, and Jackson were men of their times and deserved to be held accountable to contemporary standards of morality, not to those of a later, more sensitive age. Yet in making this contention, these voices, many of them men and women of goodwill, some of whom have done much to hold the founders accountable for their sins, these same voices err on the side of oppression, for to accuse us of anachronism, for criticizing the founders for slavery and Indian removal, because it was allegedly not a sentiment of their times, is to choose to side with them against their victims. For assuredly, hundreds of thousands of American Indians who were contemporaries to the founders must have condemned Indian removal, just as hundreds of thousands of slaves who were contemporary in the 18th and 19th century, condemned slavery. Are they not men of their times and women of their times, of Washington's time, of Jefferson's time, of Jackson's time? Of course they are. We condemn their oppressors, those of us who do, because it is a tradition handed down in the black community and in those progressive segments of the white community from ancestors who condemned it while it occurred. America has simply chosen not to remember the many thousands gone who cried oppression, the tens of thousands who fled to British lines during the so-called war, American War for Liberty, which Professor Berlin has done so much to document. And now, in 2008, when we mark the 200th anniversary of the slave trade, we hear almost nothing throughout this broad land in commemoration. Even in Boston University, it is the daughters and sons of those same victims and people of goodwill who gathered to commemorate this important event. I mean, America is at a turning point symbolized by the candidacy of Barack Obama. We can continue to forget, or we can look deeply into our past and embrace who we are. That, I suggest, is the only path to sanity. Now it is my great pleasure to present to you a historian who has done an extraordinary amount to recover that lost past in a great number of scholarly works. Ira Berlin received his B.S. and M.A. and Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin. At the University of Maryland, he holds the title of Distinguished University Professor, and he has served as Dean of Undergraduates and Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And even with those duties, he has generated extraordinary scholarly output. Dr. Berlin is also a past president of the Organization of American Historians. He has written extensively on American history and the larger Atlantic world in the 18th and 19th centuries, particularly on the history of slavery. His many books include Slaves Without Masters, The Free Negro and the Antebellum South, Many Thousands Gone, The First Two Centuries of Slavery in North America, which won the Bancroft Prize for Best Book in American History. In 2002, his book Generations of Captivity, A History of Slaves in the United States, was awarded the Albert Beveridge Prize by the American Historical Association and the Ansfield Wolf Award. He will speak to us today on the closing of the slave trade and the transformation of slavery in the U.S., please join me in welcoming Professor Ira Berlin.
Well, thank you for that very generous introduction, and thank you for inviting me here. And thank whoever else designed this really wonderful room. It's beautiful. Beautiful room. We don't have many rooms like this at the University of Maryland, so I'm pleased to be here. I'm going to talk today about the closing of the slave trade and its implications for African-American life, for slavery, for Southern history, and for the larger American history. They're all bound up, as Professor Richardson said, in this extraordinary moment in 1808 and the closing of the slave trade. And, of course, on January 1st, 1808, the United States Congress officially abolished American participation in the transatlantic slave trade. It followed the British abolition of the trade by a year, and it's often thought to be simply subsidiary of the British decision, and really not much effect on American history. Really, the only people who recognized it at the time and celebrated it at the time and made it, in fact, into their holiday were African Americans. Most contemporary white Americans paid it very, very little mind, and historians have generally followed them. And, of course, we come to 1808, and we find that most Americans continue to ignore this anniversary. So this is a really good occasion that you've chosen to open the books on 1808 and take a look at some of the changes, some of the implications of that. And I'd like to talk a little bit about those implications, both for slavery and free blacks in antebellum America, and how it shaped or reshaped the African-American experience, how it reshapes the Southern experience, both white and black, and talk about how the United States becomes a very, very different, very, very different society. In fact, I think the closing of the slave trade in 1808 is an event which is truly transformative. In many ways, it's probably one of the most important pieces of legislation that the American Congress passes, really at any time before the general emancipation during the Civil War. The close of the slave trade transforms the demography of the United States, its economy, its politics. It has an obvious effect, of course, on black people, but beyond that, the United States really becomes a different country after 1808. Prior to 1808, American participation in the international slave trade is expanding rapidly. The number of Africans who are entering the United States is increasing so rapidly in the decade prior to 1808 that we witness in those 10 years the largest influx of African slaves in any period in American history. This enormous increase in the number of Africans seems to derail what everybody expected to happen. That is the silent conclusion of American participation in the African trade. And in fact, the largest slaveholding section of the United States, that is the area of the Chesapeake, of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, parts of North Carolina, had really ended the importation of Africans sometimes in the middle of the 18th century, in large measure because they had already established an indigenous reproducing slave population, a population which more than satisfied the number of laborers. So that by the middle of the 18th century, that is almost a half a century prior to 1808, planters in the Upper South, or that Chesapeake area, were already talking about having an excess or a surfeit of slaves. They were fearful that the importation of additional slaves would reduce the value of the extant population, and Chesapeake slaveholders become the great opponents of the international slave trade. So when the American Revolution comes along, a revolution which elevates this principle of human human liberty, and at the same time seems to increase the danger, ironically, of slave revolts. Members, the kind of active political arm of the planter class in the Chesapeake, people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, those people who end up on the currency, who are then sitting in the Continental Congress, lead a movement to close the trade, and they force other parts of the Continental colonies, the New Englanders who are the big slave traders, the Lower South planters who are still importing slaves, they force them to acquiesce to this closing of the slave trade. But the revolution brings very important changes, particularly to the Lower South, where a large part of the slave population escapes or is killed during what essentially is a massive civil war in South Carolina and Georgia. It demonstrates to New England merchants that the trade can be extremely, extremely lucrative. And at the Continental Congress, at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, then these elements, the Lower South and the North, win an extension of the slave trade. And in the last decade of the 18th century, South Carolina and Georgia, and then under different auspices, Louisiana, reopen the transatlantic trade, and these number of Africans begin to flood into the United States. Now, this reopening of the slave trade in the years following the American Revolution re-Africanizes the black population of what is now the United States. Something like 100,000, by our best estimates, probably more, slaves enter the United States in that last decade. Now that is an extraordinarily large proportion of the slave of Africans who eventually come to mainland North America. It may be as much as 25%, perhaps even more. So suddenly, an African American population, a population which has become indigenous to the United States, which by the time of the American Revolution is one generation, two generation, three generation, born on this side of the Atlantic, it comes together. And meets its African forebears. And if we can see the kind of connections, particularly in places like South Carolina, the South Carolina Sea Islands, parts of the Louisiana, if we can see the connections between Africa and African America in those regions, it probably owes its cultural connections to this reopening of the slave trade and this re-Africanization of the black population. We can also think of the significance of this re-Africanization of the population and the significance of the closing of the slave trade in 1808 by engaging in a kind of counterfactual speculation. What would have happened if 1808 had not happened, if they did not close the slave trade in 1808, if it remained open? Certainly, the Black Belt, that is that rich area which becomes the heartland of the antebellum South, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, along the Mississippi River up into Arkansas, across the Mississippi River into Texas, probably would have been peopled by Africans, directly imported from Africa. The arrival of probably hundreds of thousands, maybe more, Africans with the African slave trade remaining open, may well have pushed the repeal of the Northwest Ordinance. There were people in Illinois and Indiana and Ohio pushing for the repeal of the Northwest Ordinance. If, in fact, an African population was available, it could be that the Midwest also would have been peopled by Africans. And if that is true, one can imagine that the 19th century would not have been a century of white immigration from Europe, but instead a century of black immigration from Africa. Perhaps American population would not have ended up being some 10% of African descent, but probably more like 30 or 40% of African descent. In other words, the closing of the slave trade clearly is extremely important if we think of what the other possibilities were. But of course, Chesapeake slaveholders who control the American government continue to press their case. During the first session of the first Congress, during a debate over a tariff bill, Representative Joshua Parker of Virginia attempts to limit the slave trade by proposing a $10 tax on imported slaves. When the 20-year limitation that the Constitution allows for the importing of slaves finally comes up in 1808, it has a very strong support by that Virginia-born president, Thomas Jefferson, who urges Congress to quickly pass legislation to abolish the transatlantic trade. Virginians eventually control the presidency in the years that follow. They enforce the ban. In 1818, the annual messages by Madison, then somewhat later by Monroe, talk about using American naval power in conjunction with the British to end the slave trade. They declare the African slave trade piracy. They make participation in the slave trade punishable by death. But if the Virginians, if the Chesapeake slaveholders fought hardest to end the trade, they had no problem with slavery itself and no problem with the selling of slaves. In fact, these men who fight to end the slave trade encouraged the expansion of slavery. Thomas Jefferson, with the purchase of that great empire for liberty, which of course ends up as an empire for slavery, the Louisiana Purchase, James Monroe, with the similar purchase of Florida from the Spanish. They work hard to prevent any limitation on the expansion of slavery, and they will not brook any discussion of the end of the movement of slaves into the territory. A good indication of the motives of the Virginians who are opposed to the transatlantic slave trades comes in the debate over the Louisiana Purchase in 1804. Some Northerners by this point want slavery prohibited in the Louisiana Purchase. The South Carolina, Georgia representatives, for reasons of their own, want only slaves taken to the new territories by migrating owners. But the Virginians, led by Jefferson again, fight to permit the entry of any American-owned slave into the territories, including those who are bought just for sale. And, of course, thousands, tens of thousands of slaves are taken west. When the slave trade is threatened, John Randolph, another Virginia representative, threatens to blow up the Union. In other words, this is the kind of sine qua non of their participation in this new republic. The quid pro quo, in short, for the close of the international slave trade is the creation of an internal slave trade. And that internal slave trade, or what has been called the Second Middle Passage, then transforms the United States, its economy, its politics, its culture, its white population, its black population. Between the beginning of the 19th century and the American Civil War, slaveholders transport over 1 million African American slaves from the Upper South to the Lower South. This is one of the largest forced migrations in history. It becomes, of course, one of the great businesses in the United States. It becomes the lifeblood of slavery's expansion. It creates what we can call the Solid South. The creation of this internal slave trade solidifies support for slavery in the Upper South. It ends all of the discussions of slavery being a nefarious institution. We can see planters like Jefferson who talked about an excess of slaves now see in the slaves that they own a great asset which could be mortgaged to produce even more wealth. Human property, most particularly enslaved children and young people, since most of the slaves who are carried west are literally teenagers, children by our own contemporary definition. That becomes the great export of the Upper South to the Lower South. The internal slave trade, in other words, links these two southern sub-regions, the farming states of the Upper South and the plantation or cotton or sugar states of the Lower South. It gives them a common concern. This inter-regional trade creates greater value for slave property for anybody who owns it. It puts to rest any of the lingering doubts that Southerners may have about the future of that institution. It ties all slaveholders together. It also, in a very important way, this internal slave trade gives non-slaveholders an interest in slavery. One of the perennial great questions that American historians often ask themselves is that why does the mass of white Southerners who own no slaves, who have nothing to do with slavery, go out and slaughter themselves in defense of the planter class? And if we take a look at the operation of this internal slave trade, we see that this internal slave trade allows them to buy into slavery. That is, slaves move from, say, Virginia, the banks of the James, move to the Mississippi River, can move at, you know, the rate of 10, 15 miles a day, which means every day, you know, you've moved 10 or 15 miles, you've got 500 miles to go, but then you've got to house those slaves, you've got to feed those slaves, you've got to see that those slaves don't run away, you've got to catch them when they do run away. Who does all of that work? Mostly non-slaveholders. They provision, they sell, they provide services for the slave trade. And in doing so, we see how they're able to earn a little bit of cash on the side, in which gives them a kind of buy-in to this institution, which often it's said that they don't have much interest, much material interest in. We think of slavery, of course, as a sectional institution, and the effects of, but to think of the effects of the closing of the slave trade and the creation of this new slaveholding state as simply regional is, I think, is a mistake. Slavery, the slave trade, makes slavery a national institution, which creates and shapes a national economy, creates a national politics, and will eventually create the ideas, the culture, which becomes central to American life. Slaves become the most valuable source of wealth in the United States. In 1860, 4 million slaves. Multiply that by an average price of $1,000. We've got $4 billion, worth three times the value of all American manufacture in 1860. Including railroads, livestock, the rest, worth seven times the value of all of the monies in all American banks, some 50 times the federal budget in 18, uh, in 1860, slavery becomes the great source of wealth, not simply for the South, but for the nation, as well. For the South, of course, it's obvious. For the North, not so obvious. But then we take a look that cotton and sugar become the two great exports of Northern society. Northern states, New York, for example, which is liquidating slavery during the 19th century, slavery is actually growing in importance. New York's economy becomes organized around the export of cotton and sugar. New York's manufacturing, producing cheap clothes, shoes, cotton gins for the South, becomes the basis for manufacturing in New York. New York service industry, banking, insurance, shipping, of course, is deeply implicated in the institution of slavery. And it's in that context, when the South attempts to secede in 1860, the mayor of New York, Ferdinando Wood, wants to secede along with the South. He wants out because his whole economy is connected to the South. Politics, of course, follows economics. The great political alliance, which dominates in the nation between the election of Andrew Johnson and the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, the Democratic Party becomes the dominant political institution. It is based upon an alliance that Martin Van Buren calls an alliance of planters and plain Republicans, slaveholders in the North, yeomen in the South. They dominate American politics. They shape the issues of the questions of expansion into the Southwest, the use of the army to clear out Native Americans, the creation of a land policy which allows for the development of plantations rather than farms, the creation of a tax policy which supports the development of a slave industry, the creation of an infrastructure which allows for that expansion, a foreign policy which encourages rapprochement with Great Britain, the great customer for American cotton. Nothing is more important to the Democratic Party than the free movement of that slave property, the interstate slave trade. Now, the Democratic Party is not simply the party of slavery. It is the party of planters and plain Republicans. It is the party of democracy. The Democratic Party speaks to the expansion of the suffrage, the opening up of the vote to all white men. It speaks of the expansion of office holding so that almost anybody can hold office even if they don't have any property. It speaks to the creation of what we call today civil society, the infrastructure of democracy. It becomes the great boast of the American Republic. We are the wave of the future. We are a democracy. But of course, it had to be a white democracy. This democracy could only be for white people. This expansion of slavery by the ruling organization necessitated a new racial policy and a new racial ideology. Race becomes a defining characteristic of American democracy. And during the 19th century, we see increasingly there is literally no room for black people who are free, whether it's the system of segregation of free blacks or whether it's the demand for the physical removal of free blacks, as with colonization and the creation of Liberia, with its capital of Monrovia, named after that Virginian president, or whether it's simply a new racial ideology which increasingly is reading black people out of humanity. This very same process, which is creating a democratic slaveholding nation, a national economy based upon slavery, a national politics which rests upon slavery, a national ideology which is strengthening slavery, however, at the same time is creating the circumstance which is going to undermine slavery and eventually destroy slavery. And here again, we see the critical role that this closing of the slave trade played. In 1808, when Congress votes to close the slave trade, Virginia had the largest slave population of any state in the nation. It had the largest delegation in the House of Representatives. Its sons held the presidency and would continue to do so for at least another two decades. By 1860, the internal slave trade and the operations of the internal slave trade had changed all of that. Although still symbolically important, Virginia was no longer the preeminent political power in the South, and it was even less so in the nation as well. Much of this had to do with the forced migration of new peoples and the redistribution of that slave population. The close of the slave trade and the subsequent demise of slavery in the North meant that the North had to look elsewhere for its labor supply. And these ultimately became free European workers who came from Europe rather than enslaved Africans. As their numbers expanded in the North, especially after 1830s, with this flood of Irish and German immigrants, these newcomers settled mostly in northern cities. Some went to upper south cities like Baltimore and St. Louis, but the vast majority had settled in the north, drawn by what they saw as superior economic opportunities, and most particularly a desire not to be competing with black labor. In the first federal census in 1790, the nation's population was split almost equally between the northern states and the southern states. By 1820, the North had achieved a slight majority. By 1860, the population of the North was roughly about 19 million compared to only 12 million in the southern states, 4 million of whom were slaves. Consequently, we see a shift in power. In 1820, the northern states now had enough population to capture the House of Representatives. By the 1850s, the North captured the Senate of the United States. By 1860, of course, it would capture the presidency. Now, these whites who are filling up the North are participating in a labor system which at base is articulating very, very different values, the values of free labor. It's articulating and emphasizing achieved status, merit, rather than ascribed status, fixed status. It identifies the good society not so much with hierarchy, but with mobility and equality, or at least equality of a particular kind. It speaks of competition, its ambitions, and its essential aspiration, which it projects on all mankind, is for self-improvement, for education, through betterment. It sees labor as the source of everything it values. Or as Lincoln says, if the hands can feed the mouth, the hands can feed the mouth, then you can transform yourself. You can make of yourself something. You can make of yourself something different. And you can enjoy all of those values which Americans then associate with liberty. You can control your own family. You can control your own family life. You can control your own religious life, your own intellectual life. Nobody can tell you what to read. You can control your own political life. But most importantly, you can remake yourself, all of which begins with labors, the hands feeding the mouth. In other words, these are ideas which are inimical to the institution of chattel bondage. Even when those slaves were black, and even when those slaves become the despised other. But here again, the closing of the slave trade has a very, very important and subversive effect on the power of American racism. Slaveholders and Northern racists as well identify the other, the despised other, blackness, with Africa. They see Africa as savage, as different, as a source of idiocy, as a source of laziness, as a source of libidinous behavior. All of the negatives become identified with Africa. But the closing of the slave trade in 1808 demonstrates that American slaves are no longer Africans. They're African Americans. They speak English. They're identified with the American landscape. They share the values of other Americans, of domesticity. They're creating families as best they can in a very difficult situation. Their ideology, their political ideology, which we come to know mostly at the end of slavery, is largely Republican. They're being transformed into Christians, and in some ways during the 19th century, they're embracing a new kind of Christianity that they themselves are coming. This manifestation of slaves being African American makes it increasingly difficult for them to be painted with the brush of African savagery. And in fact, abolitionists use the very African Americanness of slaves as one of their strong suits. Frederick Douglass is forever paraded around, as are other escaped slaves, to demonstrate how much of an American slaves are. In his language, in his ability, in his desire to improve and better himself, in his embrace and articulation of middle class values, all of those things make it possible, and increasingly difficult then for slaveholders to identify slaves with this other. It begins to make room within the North for a movement within an essentially racist society in ways to think about opposition to slavery and what we will call eventually not abolitionism but free soilism. Meanwhile, this close of the international slave trade and the expansion of the internal slave trade is creating important divisions within the South itself. Changing the demographics plays such a big role in Virginia's decline and its loss of influence in Southern politics. The internal slave trade is carrying more and more of the Southern population west into this new Southwest, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. In 1790, some 45% of all Southerners lived in Virginia. By 1820, that figure drops to 28%. By 1860, only 12% of the Southern slave population in Virginia. In 1790, Virginia was the kind of geographic center of the nation's black population. By 1860, the geographic center of the black population was somewhere west of Georgia or somewhere in eastern Alabama. There already were four slave states which had larger slave populations than Virginia. In contrast, the slave population of the Deep South, of course, had soared. In these same years, the slave population of Alabama had grown by almost 400,000. The growth of Mississippi's slave population was even more spectacular. In 1820, there were some 33,000 slaves in Mississippi. By 1860, there is almost 500,000 slaves in Mississippi. The states of the Lower South, the states of the Black Belt, then gain in population and they gain in their commitment to slavery, and they become, their politicos become, the regional advocates, the great regional advocates for the protection of the institution of slavery. Politicians from those states become the spokesmen for slavery. They take the leadership in the confrontation with an increasingly active anti-slavery movement in the North. And with the election of 1860 and his promise to stop the expansion of slavery in the territories, it was politicians from the Lower South, not so much the Virginians, who began to exercise their newfound power, take the lead in determining the Southern response to what they see as the threat from Lincoln and from free soilism. These men, their very economic livelihood at stake, connected to slavery, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, all benefit tremendously from the interregional slave trade, all become prosperous because of it. With the exception of Texas, a new state, these states all had 44% or more of their population enslaved. They were greatly dependent upon slavery for their prosperity. When its demise is threatened, it's those who rise to the threat. In Mississippi's Declaration of Secession in 1860, where it states why it must secede, it says, "We must either submit to the degradation or lose our property worth $4 billion of money. We must secede from the Union." It's the Lower South which is pushing this movement out of the Union. The Upper South's commitment to slavery, however, is not quite as strong. That unity between the Upper South and the Lower South is weakening. And it's weakening in large measure because of the existence of that internal slave trade, which is leeching slaves out of states like Virginia and Maryland and Kentucky and Missouri, and then over time North Carolina and Tennessee, leeching slaves out. What Southerners call the slave drain, which promises, in a kind of nightmarish scenario, which promises to make those states of the border South and then the upper South into free states. Now, whether or not the interregional slave trade was actually transforming the Upper South into free states is perhaps questionable, but certainly many, many people believed it to be so. Reinforcing this drain on slaves from the Upper South was another drain, not so much to the Deep South, but to the North. It's driven by the fact that an increasingly knowledgeable African-American population, a population which is, again, English-speaking, familiar with the landscape, skilled in all kinds of ways of people being native-born, being able to use their knowledge often gained by listening into discussions at their master's table, by their literacy or growing literacy, by their connections, familial connections, and webs of kinship that have been developed amongst this native population, use that knowledge and those connections to begin to escape from slavery in the Upper South, particularly the border states, places like Maryland and Kentucky and Missouri, and move into the North. And a large number of slaves do this. Probably not so large as to begin to subvert slavery, but to have another effect within the South. How do you keep a slave who can do what Frederick Douglass has done, get on the train in Baltimore as a slave and get off the train in Philadelphia as a free man? How do you prevent him from doing that? And the answer is slaveholders and slaves are willing to deal. They're willing to deal. Slaves don't want to run away, don't want to leave their communities, this network of kin and friends which they're established. They're not so sure about what the advantages of moving to the North are anyway. So they offer, or perhaps their master offers them a deal. Work for me for another 5 years. Don't give me any trouble. Perhaps pay me, a couple of $100, and I will free you. We get the development all along the upper reaches of the South of what is called term slavery, a recognition of this bargaining back and forth, and the new power that slaves have with their ability simply to run away. By 1860, the free black population of Maryland is larger than the slave population. The free black population of Kentucky and Missouri are growing. The free black population of Northern Virginia is increasing. In short, increasingly, slavery is on the ropes in the Upper South, in the border South. And slaveholders in that region can now see the handwriting is on the wall. They also see what Abraham Lincoln sees, what Free Soiler sees, the belief that you could destroy slavery within the American political system, dam it up, prevent it from expanding, allow this double leeching process, slaves being pulled off to the lower South by the workings of the internal slave trade. Slaves running away to the North or negotiating their freedom in the border states, and eventually you could make Maryland into a state which perhaps becomes a free state. You can begin to use the levers of political power, patronage, and all of the kinds of goodies that the federal government can supply. To eventually eliminate slavery, isolate it eventually in the Deep South, and then by constitutional means eliminate the institution of slavery. Lincoln, of course, says that it's going to take about a century to do. He's willing to live with that, as are many Northerners. But it's precisely that kind of fear that slaveholders in the lower South have, which lead them in 1860 to make a preemptive strike against this slow process which is destroying slavery. It turns out to be an enormously disastrous mistake. They probably could have played the game out for another century. Instead, they have a four-year civil war which will eventually destroy the institution of slavery. The closing then of the slave trade in 1808 then kind of ripples through American history, at once strengthening the institution of slavery, creating new elites, creating new economies, creating new political alliances, and then this same closing of the slave trade and the creation of an internal slave trade begins to have exactly the opposite effect, destroying those elites, destroying that economy, forcing slaveholders into a decision which turns out, from their perspective, a very bad decision, and allowing finally the end of slavery. 1808 is not simply an appendage on a British decision 1 year later, but a critical event for understanding what happens in American life in the generations, in the decades to follow. Thank you so much.
You mentioned something very intriguing at the end, that slavery, the process could have been played out perhaps for 100 years. Do you see slavery, the possibility that slavery could have gone on into the 1940s and 50s or so?
Well, Lincoln in his debates with Douglas gives that 100-year figure, but,
right.
Yeah, about how long he thinks it could last. It's difficult to say, but if we think of it this way, slavery in the North, clearly not nearly as powerful as the institution it becomes in the Southern states. The process of ending slavery in the North begins with the American Revolution, and it doesn't end until the 1820s when New York finally. So that's 50 years. That's slavery in the North. We know that slaveholders in the North have ways of playing out this game. They find all kinds of legal subterfuges to delay it. They sell their slaves to places where slavery continues to exist. They create systems of indentureship, which so that, for example, slavery is ended in New York in 1799, on, of course, what day you're an American, you want to end slavery? July 4th, of course. Of course, on July 4th, 1799, nobody is freed. Those people born after July 4th, 1799, will be free. So you can see how already, you know, slavery in New York is stretched out, you know, generously defined by the New York Emancipation Act as age 27 for women and 29 for men. So surely slavery would have gone well into the late 19th century, perhaps longer.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University as part of the 200th anniversary of the ending of the U.S. Atlantic slave trade. Speaking on the closing of the slave trade and the transformation of slavery in the U.S. was University of Maryland Professor Ira Berlin. Dr. Berlin was introduced by Ronald Richardson, Director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Rachel Paste and Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.